No set of circumstances, no intention can make an evil object good.
Okay.
And once one of the parts is evil, the act is by its nature evil.
Searching for a homeschooling program to build strong, faithful Catholic students? Mother of Divine Grace School has served families worldwide for 30 years, guiding them in implementing a truly Catholic, classical education right at home. Founded by author and homeschooling mother Laura Berquist, Mother of Divine Grace School is fully accredited and provides homeschooling consulting services that support parents as the primary educators. To learn more about enrolling, call 805-646-5818 or click the link above or below in the description.
Hey, thanks for joining us today on Our Reason for Hope. I just found out the other day from one of our producers that, you know, more than half the people that watch this show, this podcast, do not subscribe to us. This is insane. I mean, what are you waiting for? Hit the subscribe button now. All right, back to the show.
All right. Welcome back to A Reason for Hope podcast. I'm Jack. I'm here with Dr. David Hyduk, our Director of Theology at Array of Hope. And we're here to talk about what makes something good or evil. Have you ever wondered what makes something right or wrong, good or evil? Is it merely social construction or convention? Is it herd instinct? Is it a mere product of our evolution? Or is there some kind of universal law of right or wrong behavior?
I think you're trying to sound like a British guy narrating that.
Oh, am I?
Yeah.
Oh, you think so, David?
Yes. C.S. Lewis.
But if there's such a law, how do we know it? It's my Russell Brand. I have different accents from the different parts of Great Britain. If there's such a law, how do we know it? What are its basic precepts? Where does divine revelation come in? And lastly, how does one go about making good moral choices in today's world? What are the main things one must consider? So Dave is going to help us ponder these questions and offer some answers that come from the Catholic intellectual tradition. He contends that while making moral choices can seem very complicated due to the complexities of our times and the variety of situations in which we find ourselves, doing so actually is very simple. I like to keep things simple, so I can't wait to hear what Dave has to say. So let's get started. Dave, I guess the first and most important question is there such a thing as a universal moral law? You'll hear a lot about how morality is socially constructed, and thus it's really tied to a particular time and place, and so it's kind of fluid based on the society or civilization that, morality in this sense would come up in. But is there really a universal moral law?
Well, of course, I think there is. Now, the question is, like, why should we think that? And I really love the first three chapters or so of C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, for the answers to this question. And I'll be drawing from that in the first part of this conversation, which is why we did a whole spoof on the C.S. Lewis in the British accent in the beginning. Because he basically says that we all know there's this law, that there is this unspoken law of right and wrong behavior that everybody is aware of, and that everybody expects the other person to know. And he brings up some interesting examples, like, you know, cutting in line, you know, that say, hey, you know, why'd you cut me? You know, nobody turns around to the person who cuts them in line, who they've cut in line, and says, sorry, I'm a relativist. Nobody does that. You know, like, it's just, there's a
they
sort of—
They come up with an excuse to justify their breaking of the unspoken law.
Right, exactly. Now, of course, cutting in line is a simple thing.
Right.
It's not really a moral question, although it is on some level, maybe.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that there are these sort of ways in which we expect other people will behave, and that we feel pressing on ourselves to behave. And even people who, like, it's funny because even people who claim that there is no such law wind up going back on that, like, right in the next moment. Like, they'll be the ones crying foul about something. It's like, well, there's no foul, right? So there needs to be some sort of general acceptance of that. Like, even people who are trying to shrug off more traditional forms of morality, let's say really, really progressive folks in our culture, they're pushing their own morality. There's no such thing as like a moral vacuum. It's just one morality is replacing another morality. You can't cry out as a social justice warrior if there's no such thing as justice, and you can't have a justice if there's no such thing as good, evil, right, and wrong. So I think there's enough evidence to say, yes, we hold that there's a right and wrong, and we hold this to be true for everybody, everywhere. And it's not merely something that is developed by society for the proper ordering of society. I would turn that around, that when you have a society that's operating by universal principles of right and wrong, you'll wind up having an ordered society.
It's almost like a discovery,
right,
of the moral law. It's like, oh, this is working. Oh, this must be good and this must be evil in terms of how we're treating each other and ourselves.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not so much that it's developed for the sake of, you know, everybody getting along well in society. It's that everybody gets along well in society when it's followed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you'll hear a lot about the whole social construction thing. It's very, very common in like critical theory. So therefore, people get it fed to them a lot, that like they'll say, well, that's just a social construction. You know, they'll even do this about ideas about gender or marriage, or they'll say those are just social constructions. Well, no, they're not just social constructions. Now, obviously, there's a social convention part of it, right? So like societies develop certain ways of operating and being around certain truths, certain moral truths. You know, so you'll have laws that get developed to protect certain rights of people, or to there'll be laws that surround marriage or whatever the case may be. And those things are maybe socially constructed, but they're not, it's marriage as, you know, a permanent union between a man and a woman is not something that's socially constructed. You know, there are other things that are constructed around that truth. And the same thing about every sort of moral truth that we hold, you know, that there becomes, an example I think C.S. Lewis brings up about this is mathematics. He's like, well, you know, teaching mathematics is a social construction, right? The way in which we have an education system that teaches math. But you wouldn't say math is a social construction. Math is a fact about the universe.
Yeah.
Right? So it's kind of like that analogously. There are these facts about the universe that then, yeah, there's social conventions that get created around those things. But the thing itself is not the convention or the construction. So
I think Lewis also brings up the materialists or determinists argument, atheist argument of whether it's a herd instinct or a result of our evolution. Maybe could you speak to that?
Yeah. And some people say, well, it's not really that there's a right and wrong thing. It's that we have an instinct to a particular way of behaving because we human beings operate in herds. So we like kind of follow the crowd,
yeah,
or we do the thing that's most advantageous to our kind, so to speak.
Yeah, right.
And I think that like where this misses the mark is that if you really look at instincts, a lot of times instincts are running counter to what the moral thing is. You see? Like, you know, someone might have an instinct to punch somebody they disagree with, but that's not the moral thing to do, right? And so what does morality demand? A suppression, in a sense, of that instinct in that particular case.
Yeah.
Right? However, there may be times when we need to encourage an instinct that we don't really want to encourage because of a stronger one. Like, so for example, like we might need to suppress fear and encourage a sense of indignation if we're going to go into battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I might not want to go to battle. In fact, by nature, I might want to kind of run away. But like the fact of the matter, because it's dangerous, because it's scary, right? Yeah. But somehow I need to move myself to say, no, I need to steel my nerves and I need to go out and get the job done, because that's what you need to do. So with this said, like what you can see is that instinct may or may not move you to the thing that's actually right. Instinct may move you to the thing that's wrong. And so right and wrong, therefore, has to exist independent of the instinct, right? And we have to learn how to direct the instinct.
Right, because there's that third thing pushing you in one direction. It's the Jiminy Cricket on your shoulder saying you should really go into battle or, you know, not punch this person. So you have the instinct or the two instincts, and then this third thing kind of, that you don't really want it to tell you what to do, but it's almost like telling you what to do. It's like it's the inbuilt moral universal law.
Right. So the law stands above the instincts. Right.
Yeah.
And as far as evolution goes, like, you know, sometimes you'll hear an evolutionary approach to how morality developed. Like they'll say, well, really, morality only developed in human beings because, you know, that's the group that like had moral codes were the ones most likely to survive and thrive. And so therefore, because it built a sort of like, you know, social cohesion.
The argument though.
Well, in one way you could say, all right, well, yeah, what's the only creature that can have such a social cohesion and have such a sense of right and wrong, even if on some level it happened, you know, as human beings evolved, you know? But my thought is even this. Once I recognize that this moral thing is really just the product of evolution, not a real right and wrong, why should I care about the survival of the species?
Oh, yeah.
Why should I care about social cohesion? Why shouldn't I only care about me and mine? Right? Like, well, because you should. Well, now you're moralizing on me. You can't go and use the morality argument that there's some universal moral like duty I have to my species.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you're cutting off the branch you're sitting on.
It's like, exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So I think that this is also problematic. So like, you know, whether or not as humans developed, a better way to say is that like, you know, humans being humans had a moral sense and therefore they had a social cohesion as a result of that moral sense.
Yeah.
Regardless of how they developed.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. So if there is such a moral law as we're positing here, what would be its precepts?
All right, well, there's a fundamental precept of the natural law, or the natural moral law, and that's that good is to be done and evil is to be avoided.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's like, is there a person on the planet that would disagree with that statement? Probably not. So what are they going to get at? Okay, but what is the good that ought to be done? That's where there's going to be disagreements. What are the evils to be avoided? Now you can even know some of these things, objectively speaking. So there's a basic impulse to the good. But what's the second kind of level of the natural moral law? Propositions identifying real goods of human existence are the goods that should be done and pursued, and their opposites, evils, are to be avoided. So now we're kind of saying, okay, so what are the goods to be done? Those that are real goods of human existence, and those that are contradictory, those acts that are contradictory of those real, true human goods. Those are the things that should be avoided. So how do we know what those true, real human goods are? Well, Aquinas had one way of kind of looking at this, and he divided human goods in according to our natural inclinations. So what he said is that we have a natural inclination towards self-preservation, right? So therefore, he said, therefore, life is a good. Do you see? So life is a good, and that's a good to be pursued and promoted, But that is which is contradictory of it. You know, obviously, murder, for example, or something like that. That's an evil to be avoided, right? He would also identify sexual union as a natural inclination, which is, I think, undeniable. And we could see this, like, in all animals, you know, that for the propagation of the species, that sexual union is something that all animals are driven to, right? Now, in human beings, it's raised to the level of a rational creature, right? So the level of persons. So in human beings, it's not merely a response to an instinct, a sexual instinct, but rather it is meant to bring about the communion between a man and a woman in a faithful union that's oriented to the procreation, education of children, and life in a stable family. So, like, that's what Aquinas would say is the purpose of the good of sexual union, is this natural unit of the family and children for the sake of the continuation of the species. So you have self-preservation about the individual, then you have, like, sexual union towards the preservation of the species, right? And the good of marriage in and of itself. And then social life. So you have self-preservation, sexual union, social life. So these are goods common to life in society. For example, like truth-telling, you know, that lying would be opposed to life in society. Friendship, education, work, justice, all the things that you could think of are essential for life in society to work. And these would be called the common good, or rather goods that are common to all human beings living in society. So, now I prefer to delineate these goods differently. You know, my study of St. John Paul II and the idea of his personalism is very meaningful to me. I think this is very consonant with what Aquinas is saying. It just kind of, like, you know, puts it a little bit differently. So I look at the correspondence between the good and true human fulfillment. Okay? So the idea that things that are good for the person promote the good of the person, right? And help persons to attain the fulfillment of their nature, so to speak. Now, so I'm focusing on the fact that we are persons, human persons, who are made for a communion of persons, right? So what is it? What's the nature of the person? We have a body. So what would be goods, real goods associated with the body? Well, you've got bodily life, bodily integrity. You have things that sustain life, food, clothing, shelter, medical care, etc. You know, work. So we provide those things for ourselves, and care for creation that, like, obviously has an impact on the physical existence of human beings, right? So what you have is there are these real human goods associated with our bodily nature as a person, but we're not just a body, we're a soul, and the soul has an intellect and a will. So there are real goods associated with us being intellectual. Knowledge of the truth is a good, education is a good. You see, like, there are these things that are goods for us being intellectual creatures. Then we have a will. So things related to choices, religious freedom, understood here as the fundamental right to be free to seek ultimate truths. And also involves the recognition that faith has to be a free choice, right? Freedom of speech, formation in virtue, you know, like, these kinds of things are associated with the will, right? Freedom of conscience. And then communion. We're persons created for a communion of persons. So what are those things that have to do with communion of persons? Like marriage, family, friendship, right to social organizing, right? Equality, justice, all these things that have to do with our interpersonal lives, right? That has to do with that. So I like that way of looking at it, because to me, it makes a very clear delineation based on what is it that as persons are good for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what things are going to bring about our true flourishing as persons. And that's ultimately what the moral law is supposed to do. It's supposed to help us to attain the fulfillment of our nature as persons, and to help us to flourish as persons, and as persons, not only individually, but also in society.
Okay. So in aiming to flourish as individuals and persons and societies, how do we come to know this universal moral law?
Well, I think fundamentally, we know the moral law by way of reason when we reason correctly. The moral law is intelligible because we're intelligent beings. We're made in the image and likeness of God, and God, the source of morality, who is goodness itself, love itself, is intelligent. So the natural law, classically defined, is man's participation in God's eternal law, right? So now reason has to be done correctly. You know, like, I think you'd find people surprised to find out that, like, that reason has rules. This is one question I used to ask my students when I taught an ethics class. I said, does everybody think the same? And immediately they say, no, everybody has different ideas, blah, 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 blah. I said, I didn't ask you if people have different conclusions. I said, does everybody think the same? And they are now stumped, right?
I'm stumped.
And, you know, like, I said, meaning everybody goes from premises to a conclusion.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Everybody thinks the same, no matter who you are. There's only one way to think.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And that is what we call logic, right thinking, right? So here's the point, that you can reason correctly or incorrectly, rightly or wrongly. You can start with bad facts, and you can come sometimes to bad conclusions because you're not reasoning correctly. That's what we call logical fallacies, for example, are like errors in reasoning, yeah. Right? So why do I bring that up? Because I think we have a dearth of logic these days. So you got a lot of bad reasoning, and as a result, a lot of bad ideas about what's right, what's wrong, how morality goes, and the like. So the universal moral law is knowable by reason, but we've got to reason rightly.
So in a sense, one might assume that the universal moral law is just simply based on reason alone. So is there something that Christian theology introduces into the moral law that we can benefit from?
Well, yes, actually, because there's a classic axiom that grace builds upon and perfects nature, right? But there's another that is similar. It's that revelation builds upon and perfects reason. So the point here is that revelation confirms what we know by reason, right? But it also adds more to it that we could not have known by reason, right? So it gives us more of an insight into the law of God. Remember, the natural law is man's participation in the eternal law of God. There's no way that man's participation in the eternal law of God by reason is going to be enough to scratch the surface of that eternal law, which is equivalent to God himself, right? So divine revelation gives us more of that eternal law than we could have by reason. So for example, one example I'd like to bring up is this. We may have been able to know by reason alone that we should seek retribution proportionate to the evil done to us or to another and not exceed it. We might have been able to know that by reason alone. We probably could have figured out, you're a human being, I'm a human being, this is what you did. You know, like, we probably have gotten past the point where we burned down whole cities as a result of, like, you know, you did something, you said something mean about my mother. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that. You know, like, so there's, you know, I mean, it's a crazy, funny example, but, like, nonetheless, you get the point, right?
Yeah.
You know, but we probably could have come to that by reason alone. But I'm telling you, I don't think we could have ever gotten to, we should love our enemies without revelation.
Mm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, like, there's an example of how divine revelation gives us something that we didn't have before.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really important way.
The first will be last and the last will be first.
Yeah, no way. No way.
Yeah, yeah.
Where am I going to get? I'm not going to come up with that one by reason alone, right?
Yeah.
Now, there's also the grace thing, and this is the other thing that Christianity tells us. I mean, due to the impact of fallen nature, we have a strong inclination to evil, right? Our default mode is to rebel against God and his law. So while there are moral choices that are within our natural capacity to make, even they can be quite difficult for us to follow through on as a result of our fallen nature. other moral choices, like the demands that Jesus makes, like the ones we've mentioned, would be downright impossible. Even Jesus says, for man it's impossible, but with God all things are possible. You know, he says that about the situation with the rich young man when his apostles are questioning him, well, who can be saved if it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get to heaven. So what he's saying there is that we need grace to live out the fullness of the moral law. Mm-hmm. We need grace to live out what he is revealing about morality, right? So that's why we need prayer and the sacraments. So that's the other thing that I think Christianity adds. So it adds more info as well as confirming what we can know by reason,
yeah,
more demands, but then it also adds the grace to actually succeed in fulfilling both the demands of nature and the demands of what God has revealed.
Mother of Divine Grace School has served homeschooling families worldwide for 30 years. Founded by author and homeschooling mother, Laura Berquist, Mother of Divine Grace School is fully accredited and passionate about supporting parents as the primary educators. Laura states, "We exist to help Catholic families raise their children in a living Catholic culture in their homes, mentoring them and using the MODG, Catholic Classical Curriculum, to lead their children to good judgment concerning the good, true, and beautiful." With effective school-wide learning goals, students are formed to be active learners, effective communicators, independent thinkers, and multifaceted individuals. Graduates have been accepted into 18 of the top 25 schools in the nation and pursue degrees across a wide variety of fields. To learn more about enrolling, you can visit their virtual open house, call 805-646-5818, or click the link above or below in the description.
Hello, and thanks for being with us here on A Reason for Hope podcast. Been very grateful of the many years that we've been doing this for you. This is our sixth season with hundreds of podcasts already released. Although they're free to watch and listen to, they're not free to produce. So I'm asking that you discern to contributing and donate to A Reason for Hope podcast. We're a nonprofit organization. Every dollar, every penny is tax deductible. All you have to do is go to our website and click donation and navigate the podcast. All the funds that you donate will go to the production of this podcast. Thanks again, and may God bless you.
There's a nice movie. I think it's a two-part movie on St. Philip Neri. I think it's all in Italian, and it's really good. I think it's called
Felipe
in vivo in paradiso, you know, or something like that. That's like the last line of the movie once he dies, and all of his, you know, all the children he was essentially housing and taking care of that he brought off the streets, you know, were chanting at the end of the movie, Filippo in vivo in paradiso. Really, really beautiful movie. And in the movie, one of his students essentially comes to him and says, you know, it was sort of this prodigal son moment where one student had sort of fallen away and came back, and then the other student who had remained faithful came to St. Philip, and he said, you know, why is the gospel so hard to live? You know, like, I'm jealous that you're, you know, welcoming this student back, etc. Why is the gospel so hard to live? And St. Philip says, well, because it's so simple, you know, and so in a sense, you could assume that, well, because it's so simple, as St. Philip Neri would say in this movie, I don't know if he actually said that, it's perhaps easy. But I feel like a lot of people would say, no, well, it's not easy. It's actually very complex. But I think when you really think about it, it is simple. And so it should be easy. Why do you think maybe it could be easy? It could be simple.
Okay. So, like, first, I think it's not easy insofar as living the demands of the moral law. And that's because we have a fallen nature, right? So I think that our sinful nature, being what it is, always wants us to act in a different way than actually is that the way that's for our best interest, that's going to bring about our true fulfillment. I mean, think about it. God created us in his image and likeness to be like him. And there's no way to fulfill the meaning of our existence without living according to his law, because his law is nothing other than the goodness, which is him, right? So this is, I think, a key point. We wind up shooting ourselves in the foot and acting against our own best interest all the time in the name of the fleeting pleasure, the temporary fix, the sinful thing that looks attractive. I mean, let's not, right. It's not sugarcoat it. People aren't doing it because it looks bad.
Yeah.
Right? It looks good. It looks like it's going to fulfill me, and it won't, but it gives that promise, doesn't it? So, but that's what I mean, like self-defeating. So I think that's why it's hard. Our nature being fallen makes it hard. But I'll also say this, in some ways, it is really easy. It's really easy to know the right thing to do. It's more difficult to actually choose it because of what we just talked about. But I mean, it's actually quite easy. But first, let's backtrack. We have to have the mind that each and every human action is not simply a choice to do this or that thing, but it's a choice to be this or that kind of person. So free choices are self-determining. I am what I choose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So they make us either a good person or a bad person. People say, oh, there's no such thing as an evil person. What? Seriously? Okay, if what you mean by that is, people are fundamentally good. They're created good, but they're created by God. They're good, right? They're made in God's image. Therefore, they're good. So if what you mean is ontologically we're good, fine.
Oh,
Yeah. I get you. There's no such thing as a bad person because everybody's ontologically good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
By the way, the fallen angels are ontologically good. For the record, they're bad.
Yeah.
And human beings can be too. And how do they become so? By what they freely choose to be. I think it was C.S. Lewis who said that through our free choices, we make ourselves into either a heavenly or hellish creature. And when we die, we just go where we belong. So sort of an interesting thing to think about. Now, how is it that we make ourselves what we are? By what we choose.
Mm-hmm.
So some choices help us to become fully human and like God, and others don't.
Okay, so Dave, how do we decide what to choose in terms of morally right and wrong?
Okay, so traditionally speaking, there's three aspects of every moral choice. This is like the way in which St. Thomas Aquinas saw the moral act, the human act. There's the object of the choice. That is the thing actually being done, right? There's the end, sometimes called the intention of the choice, why you did it. But now we have to keep in mind that when we're talking about the end, we're really talking about the proximate end, the nearest end, what it is you're intending, not the remote end or the ultimate thing that you're intending. So I'll give you an example of the difference.
Machiavellian sort of philosophy versus, just because an end is good doesn't mean that the means to get there justify it. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, in a way, it's sort of related to that in the sense that, for example, let's use euthanasia as an example, right? People will say, well, I gave them these drugs so they would no longer be in pain.
Okay.
Right? So they might say, oh, see, that's a good end.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but no, that's not your end. The intention is to kill them.
Okay. It's a little different.
That's the proximate
end. It's a little different.
That's the proximate end.
Okay.
The remote end is for them not to feel pain, but you eliminate the suffering by eliminating the sufferer.
Okay.
You see?
Yeah.
So there's, in that sense, you have to keep in mind that sometimes people can have a wrong sense of what we mean by intention. We're talking about what you have the object and then the intention that you're most closely associating with that choice.
Okay.
And then the circumstances is the third aspect, which are all the different things that surround the choice You know, this is like the how, this is the where, this is like, you know, to whom. These are other circumstances. The
context.
Right. You know, so all three of these things have to be good for the act to be morally good. If any one of these three things is evil, the act is defective, okay, and therefore it's all evil. So the first thing that you need to like kind of decide here, everything really centers first and foremost on the object, the thing that's being chosen. Is the object in itself, is the act in itself good or evil? In order to move on to the end and circumstances and consideration of those, the first thing that has to be known is if the object itself is good or evil. So the object in and of itself has to be at least good or morally neutral before the rest. So imagine the direct and intentional killing of an innocent person. That's what we typically call murder, right?
Typically.
That's intrinsically evil,
yeah,
meaning in itself it's evil.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that can make that good. And so as a result, no good reason or circumstance can make it good. Now, this defies the modern mindset, particularly in Western cultures, because they'll bring this up. Well, what if, like, you know, a terrorist is going to blow up, like, you know, a city full of people, and what you need to do is just murder this one person? Isn't it better to murder that one person and save the city rather than have this whole city, all these people in the city get blown up? And the answer to that is no. No set of circumstances, no intention can make an evil object good.
Okay.
And once one of the parts is evil, the act is by its nature evil. This basically fundamentally flies in the face of anybody who wants to think in a utilitarian way. The idea that somehow we can do evil so good may come from it, you know, that
like justifying the
end, justifying the means.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. But now let's, you know, there's no good reason to murder somebody. You just can't. But there might be things that you could do that would be, for example, dependent on the intention. So for example, killing a person is not always and everywhere wrong. Only the direct and intentional killing of an innocent person is always and everywhere wrong. So then you might say, okay, well, the object is you're killing a person, but what's the end of that? Well, are you intending to kill the person? Yes, but what's the point? Let's say somebody's attacking you or your country. Yeah. The point is you're really defending yourself or your country. So it's self-defense,
yeah,
is the intention. And in fact, the proper attitude towards killing this person is not that I'm trying to kill this person. The proper attitude is I am defending myself or someone else. And that's the end. The object is the killing of the person, which is not always wrong to do in itself.
Okay.
Right? There's some killing that is justifiable killing.
Okay.
And in this case, the end of self-defense would be a justifiable killing. Now, okay, let's look at the circumstances. So we've got one and two, check, check, right?
Mm.
But you might not need to kill the person in order to defend yourself,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say your hands are registered lethal weapons because you know, like, you know, some kind of martial arts or something like that, you know, like, and you can defend yourself in a way using less force than the killing. Then what the circumstances do would be what makes that act wrong. I would actually argue that this is why the death penalty is wrong in a Catholic view. It's not that the death penalty in itself is wrong, because sometimes killing a person is justified, right? It's the fact that whether the end is for legitimate defense of the state or the just you know, balancing the justice questions are involved. The fact of the matter is that the circumstances of our culture and time render it possible for us to defend society against this person and to exact the demands of justice without having to kill them to do so. So therefore, the death penalty becomes excessive force as a result of the circumstances of our time. But that's the thing that would make the death penalty evil now. It's not evil in itself. It would be evil by means of the circumstances because it's not necessary.
Oh, you're like taking me to another dimension over here.
But you get how that works?
So I think so.
Things that are intrinsically evil because they directly violate the law of God, those things can't ever be done, not even for a good reason.
So you're saying that killing, not murder, but killing is morally neutral?
A killing can be in and of itself, yes.
Depending on the end and the circumstance.
Right. Murder is not morally neutral. Here's one that's really probably on a lot of people's minds. Sex before you're married.
Okay.
Right? It's actually a direct violation of the law of God and the natural law because God forbids sexual relations outside of the marriage bond, right? So therefore, sex outside of marriage is intrinsically evil in its object.
Okay. Because of God's law, not
because
necessarily.
And the natural law.
Okay.
You know, because natural law you could even make an argument by reason alone for sexual relations being exclusively between a man and woman who are married.
Okay.
I would look to the arguments of Dr. Robert George from Princeton.
Okay.
For that.
Oh, nice. Okay. Good.
But that being said, no intention or end can make it okay. So because we love each other is irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's evil in itself, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's just this important way of getting this flow that the first thing you start is with, is the act in itself against the natural law, okay, against the eternal law of God? That would make it intrinsically evil and never to be a legitimate act that one can make.
Yeah.
Or take. And then you move on to once you establish that, you might just know, I can't choose that.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean by it becomes easy. I can't do that.
Oh, okay.
I don't have to figure out whether or not my intentions are good. No intention can make it good.
Okay.
That's why, by the way, sometimes you've heard the phrase, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Because people are doing things that are objectively evil against God's law, and they're making all kinds of good reasons why they're doing it.
The intention being the end,
okay. Right?
Okay.
So like all of that stuff comes second. The only time ends and circumstances come into play is when you're dealing with something that's morally good or morally neutral, right?
So, and then the circumstances, the context.
Right.
Yeah.
This might be a circumstance that like every father might find himself in. Okay. I want to correct my child, right? Because they've done something wrong. There's nothing intrinsically evil about that.
I think I know where you're going here,
my intention is I care about my child's good. I want them to improve. I want them to grow in virtue. I want them to become a good citizen, you know, like whatever. But let's say, even though I have a right as a dad to correct my child and I have a good intention, I want them to grow in virtue. I want them to become better. I want them to learn, become an upstanding human being.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say I fly off the handle at them and scream at them.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say I even do it in public,
mm-hmm,
completely embarrassing them. They're ashamed, like all these kinds of things. Maybe I do it in front of, you know, because I do it in public now, all kinds of people have an opinion about them. Like, that would be wrong circumstances. It would be an evil act for me to do that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So even though the object is perfectly within my rights to do, even though the end is good, the way I carry that out makes that evil.
Mm, okay. Yeah.
And I should confess that.
So the object and the end being right, but the circumstance being wrong. Nice. That was good. We didn't have an example like that.
Yes,
right?
It's a more everyday example.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I guess the last question would be, about conscience, right? Because we're talking about universal moral law and how do I know what's right and wrong? And people are usually saying, well, I have my own Jiminy Cricket to listen to, and I kind
of... He looks a lot like me.
He's my custom
and
Jiminy
Cricket.
And he wants
me to do exactly what I want to do.
Yeah, it's like, you know, my conscience this, my conscience that. And you had actually mentioned, it made me think of it earlier, you had mentioned, you know, one of the goods of, was it the soul or...
The will.
The will being freedom of conscience. Right. So that could be maybe misinterpreted.
Yes.
No, freedom of conscience. Sick.
Yeah.
Great. So, you know, we often hear that people should follow their conscience. Right. Is that true? How should we understand conscience?
Okay, so yes and no.
Okay.
It's true. So like you must follow your conscience because if you're truly have this moral sense that you must do this or must not do this, and you believe that that's directly weighing on you, to act against that is to act against what you believe God is asking you to do, right? However, conscience is more than a feeling that this is what I should do. It's, in fact, I would argue that conscience really isn't a feeling that I feel peace about this choice. That's not what it means. It's more of you must do this. You know, so you have a sense of moral obligation.
Weight, I think
weight,
you said,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a weight. Also, conscience isn't the same as prudential judgment. It isn't like, you know, well, I put the pros and cons on a piece of paper and I think there are more pros than cons, so I got to do the pros. You know, that's not it. You know, like people say, you know, in my judgment, you know, it's fine for two people of the same sex to be married. Well, you know, that, you know, so, and let's say I'm homosexually inclined, so I think it's fine for me to be married. Well, it's like, well, that's a judgment you're making. That's not a conscience decision. That's not an act of conscience. That's a misunderstanding of conscience. And, you know, you're coming up with a prudential judgment that's different than divine revelation and that's different than the natural law, perhaps, you know, for whatever reason you're coming up with that judgment. But that doesn't mean that, like, you're following your conscience when you make that choice. You're actually deciding that the natural law and the church are wrong about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different thing. It's not conscience.
Yeah, yeah.
But conscience also has to be properly formed,
mm-hmm, yeah,
and informed. Mm-hmm. And so people like to say, I'm going to follow my conscience, but they don't do anything to inform their conscience. They don't want to find out what's right. How is your conscience supposed to be formed? According to the clear and certain teaching of the church, according to what's consonant with right reasoning. You know, like that's how it's supposed to be formed. So... conscience doesn't determine what's right and wrong. It doesn't decide what's right and wrong. It applies right and wrong to specific situations, you know?
Mm.
So like, if I know, for example, that abortion is the direct and intentional killing of an innocent human being, then my conscience ought to tell me, I can't drive somebody to go have an abortion.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's the fact of it. And, you know, the fact that I feel whatever I feel, or, you know, I'm trying to do all these mental loops, you know, like to kind of justify what it is that I'm doing. The conscience should be deep. That's why, you know, people's consciences eat away at them when they make all kinds of choices in their prudential judgment. I'm going to live this way. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to, like, you know, I'll have this kind of lifestyle. I'm gonna sleep with this person. You know, I'm gonna, you know, do drugs. I'm gonna live my life the way I want to live it. That's a nightmare for slavery. Eventually, people get to a place where, like, deep down, their conscience is actually gnawing at them. There's no sense of like, I must do this. Yeah. You know, no, they're making a decision. They want to do it. That's what I mean. Like, you know. They're blaming conscience when it's really just them sitting on their shoulder telling them the thing they already want to do. That's not conscience, right? Now, it's interesting, like even in the catechism, after the part in the catechism about conscience, it says this, some rules apply in every case, no matter what. So it's going into an erroneous conscience, that even somebody who acts on an erroneous conscience, you know, it's not good that their conscience is erroneous, but they must act on it based on what they know, because they have to follow their conscience, right? But that's the state of an erroneous conscience. This isn't a good state. But then then the catechism pulls away and says, okay, but even in all this, certain things apply in every case. Number one, one may never do evil, so good may result from it. So no matter what, whatever it is your conscience is telling you, or you have an erroneous conscience or a well-formed one, you may never do good, so evil, so good may come from it. You may never, the end does not justify the means. Two, you must follow the golden rule. You should do to others what you would want others to do to you. And I constantly remind my kids when they tell me that, oh, well, you know, let's say they do something to their brother and they say, well, he did this to me. And I always say to them, oh yeah, that's what Jesus said. Do to others what they did to you. Oh, I'm sorry. What you would have them do to you. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
Go on. I'll use that.
And then of course, charity always proceeds by way of respecting the good of one's neighbor, you know? And that includes the, I think, responsibility not to cause scandal to one's neighbor. So I need to ask myself, is the thing I'm doing potentially, even though I feel like I'm following my conscience, does it present an obstacle to my neighbor in living out the moral life? Am I setting a bad example? You know, would doing this set a bad example? So those three things, it's interesting. Those three things the catechism says applies in every case, good conscience, bad conscience, informed, uninformed, what have you. Now, St. Ignatius of Loyola said that there are three questions that should be asked when you're going to make a decision. This is really stunning to me. So the first question is, what would you have wished you had done at the end of your life, like when you're on your deathbed, looking back, would you have said, I'm glad I did that? Two, what would you have wished you had done when you appear before Almighty God alone to be judged? That's pretty sobering, right? We're usually not thinking about that in the moment of making a decision.
Right.
And then lastly, what would you counsel someone else to do in your situation?
Yeah, that's a good one too, yeah.
And if you notice, those things apply to those points that the catechism brings up. So these three questions from St. Ignatius of Loyola can really help people too when we are looking at what it means to follow your conscience. You know, you can ask these fundamental questions and it might help us to realize that we're really making a decision that we're starting with, this is what I want to do, and we're trying to make everything fit.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, what is the thing I ought to do and deal with the consequences of doing the right thing, which might not feel good and might be the opposite of what I really want to do, but which is ultimately going to bring about my true flourishing as a human being and going to be the thing that's consonant with God's law. And it's going to lead me to heaven.
So watch Pinocchio is what you're saying.
That's a good one.
I love it. All right. Well, thanks, Dave. This has been very interesting. And thank you for joining us on A Reason for Hope podcast. And we'll see you next time. Thanks, Dave.
In addition to producing this podcast, A Ray of Hope is also known for producing events such as retreats, missions, conferences, and concerts. If you'd like to learn more about what we offer, just go to our website and click on Experience. There you can see and learn all the various programs that we offer. God bless you, and we hope to see you soon.